I approach now, Your Honor?
Well, that's fine, but we'll wait until everyone is seated. But of course, you may approach, of course. Okay. We'll just give everyone a chance to get settled. Number 051815, 051816, 051821, 051822, Stanley Boehm versus the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development et al. Mr. Boyd.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. The District Court granted summary judgment in this case against the Holy Land Foundation on the basis of collateral estoppel arising from District of litigation in the District of Columbia brought by the Holy Land Foundation in 2002. We've laid out in our brief the nature and course of that litigation. The fundamental issue that is raised in this appeal is whether the Holy Land Foundation or an entity like the Holy Land Foundation is entitled to any sort of day in court ever.
Let me start you off by asking you this, Mr. Boyd. Suppose we agree that the D.C. Circuit Court litigation over the designation of HLF should not be given collateral estoppel effect. Would the designation nevertheless be evidence that the fact finder could consider in assessing HLF's liability?
I don't believe so, no, Your Honor. And the reason I say that is because it is not the result of any sort of adjudicative proceeding, either at the administrative level or in the courts. And I would say that before it can be considered as such, the fact that this act, it's an accusation. That's all it is it's an accusation.
See, this really goes to the subject of intent. And my question to you is whether you think our opinion in Boehm 1 is in conflict with the D.C. Circuit's opinion as to the Holy Land Foundation. The D.C. Circuit seems to have said that knowing contributions to Hamas are enough without requiring a showing of intent.
I think, Your Honor, what the District Court and the Court of Appeals said in the District of Columbia is that that is enough for blocking and designation purposes under IEPA. There is nothing in those opinions which would say that it is enough under the act that's at issue in this case. And this court's opinion, I think, although obviously, as the court is aware, Holy Land Foundation disagreed with certain aspects, argued against certain aspects of this court's opinion when it was before this court. But this court decided what it decided, and I think imposed perhaps a lower standard than the Holy Land Foundation thought ought to be imposed, but imposed a standard that said if you are going to impose civil liability, there must be some intent and proximate cause of the death or the act of terrorism. In this case, the evidence in the record, the only admissible evidence in this record, or for that matter, for purposes of this case, the only evidence that was ever before the court in the District of Columbia that would be admissible in this case is flat, sworn denials by the Holy Land Foundation's principals that the Holy Land Foundation ever provided any sort of funding or support to Hamas for any reason.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. Boyd? One of the things that the District of Columbia court said, and then the magistrate judge here picked up, was that the Holy Land Foundation had an opportunity, at least at the redesignation stage, to put into the record whatever exculpatory evidence it wanted to. And what I've been focusing on, at least in terms of the offensive collateral estoppel argument, has been whether the procedural opportunities available to you at the asset blocking, designation, et cetera, proceeding are sufficiently different that we ought not to apply collateral estoppel. But what I would like to know is, if you had had this hearing that you wanted, what would you have done with it? You know, what would you expect to do?
If we had had the hearing in the District of Columbia
or here? I mean, you know, what is it that you have so far been precluded from either putting into the record or from showing that you now, if we were to rule in your favor, would have the opportunity to do?
Two things. First of all, proof under oath that the Holy Land Foundation has never supported Hamas.
So you're thinking like impeaching statements in the Watson memorandum? I'm just trying to get a little more concrete feel for this.
Your Honor, and forgive you may detect a little frustration in my voice, because the administrative record in this case that we would, in response to Your Honor's question, that we would impeach is nothing but inadmissible hearsay. It's newspaper articles. It is falsified translations. It is statements attributed to unidentified, sometimes reliable, confidential informants.
But
it's not anything that would be admitted in a court.
Forgive me.
Yes,
and
excuse me, Your Honor.
No, forgive me. And if you need a little more time, you're going to get it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, you know, when you say falsified translations.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's in the record in this case. There, if you look at the Watson memorandum,
which is a tome, actually.
The Watson memorandum is about 40 pages long, and then it has
lots of
attachments.
Yeah.
If you look at the Watson memorandum, there is one statement in it and one statement only where you could point to, where someone could point to it and say, now there is evidence that Holy Land Foundation supported Hamas. And that is a statement attributed to Mr. Anati, Muhammad Anati, who was the manager of the Holy Land Foundation's West Bank office, you know, public office. And the statement attributed to him was, most of our money goes to charity, but we give some to Hamas.
Now, why isn't that enough?
Because there is no such statement. There was never any such statement. In fact, what Mr. Anati said was, he said, once we got the statement translated properly, not in the form of an unauthenticated anonymous translation, what he said was, we don't make political distinctions between what children we support. They can be their parents, their deceased parents may have been members of Hamas, may have been members of the PLO, may have been collaborators with Israel. We don't make those distinctions. And then under oath before an Israeli court, he testified, we have never given a penny to Hamas, and if I thought we had, I would resign. And those are the kinds of things, and that is, in fact, the very evidence and the type of evidence, along with all of Holy Land Foundation's sworn affidavits, that was stricken from the record in the District of Columbia case.
Curious here, what's the status relevancy of the indictment against Holy Land?
I think the indictment.
There were seven individuals also indicted.
Yes, and Your Honor, I think it's critical to understand the indictment. First of all, they have all pled not guilty, but the indictment, for example, we see the statement from the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia saying the secret evidence, the administrative record plus the secret evidence persuades us that it's incontrovertible that the Holy Land Foundation supported Hamas's terrorism.
So what's the status of the indictment?
I'm saying that by way of background, and I'll answer your question directly, Your Honor, forgive me. The The status of the case is that we're in discovery. That's the status of the case. There's no trial setting. But critical importance for this court to understand is that that indictment doesn't charge the Holy Land Foundation or any of its officers with giving money to Hamas. What it charges them with is engaging in charity in the West Bank through local charity committees that the government in this indictment alleges are in some fashion affiliated with Hamas.
Well, what's the difference?
Yeah.
What is the difference?
Because, as this court said in its earlier opinion, the difference is that if you're engaging in charity, I mean, first of all, the difference is they've pled not guilty and they're presumed not guilty. But the second difference is that, as this court said in its earlier opinion, even if that were true, supporting charitable efforts in the West Bank is not something that could support the claims in this case by the Boyms, as they alleged that the Holy Land Foundation paid the money to Hamas to buy the guns, to buy the truck, to do the training, to kill the Boyms' son. There's no connection with that. There's no proximate cause. There's no intent. There's no nothing. Now, for the government to allege that that constitutes material support for terrorism, we disagree, and we particularly disagree given that the United States government, as we set out in our brief, maintains an enormous list of organizations and people that it claims are in some way affiliated with or are terrorists or are connected with terrorism. Holy Land Foundation is now on that list as a result of the designation that was litigated in the District of Columbia. Not a single one of these organizations in Palestine that they have been indicted for allegedly working with to provide support for families and children in Palestine, not a single one of those
when
is on the
list.
When
you say Palestine, is that what...
West Bank and Gaza.
All right.
Yes.
Could I just ask, I realize there are a lot of issues in this case, but a timing issue here. Obviously, the designation of Holy Land Foundation doesn't come until many years after the murder of the Boyms' son. And I will, just so that the Boyms know, be trying to find out exactly which theory of liability looks back to whatever Holy Land Foundation might be doing in 2001, 2002 to 1996. I just want to know what I understand this to be a conspiracy theory, I'll say, that the Holy Land Foundation somehow joined a conspiracy that included Hamas, and therefore under normal rules of conspiracy you can attribute actions taken earlier to the Holy Land Foundation.
Well, first of all, there's no evidence in this record of any conspiracy, and certainly that was not an issue that was before the D.C. court. That goes to the issue of collateral estoppel. But even if you were to say that the statement in the Court of Appeals opinion that the secret evidence makes it incontrovertible or whatever, there's no time on that, and the indictment, there's no date of that attribution, and the indictment charges, I believe, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it charges, the allegations are that it was 1998, 1999, 2000, 2001, which is, as the court is aware, right, significantly after that.
Okay. Let me ask you one last question regarding your motion to stay. You didn't object to the district court resolving the motions for summary judgment, did you?
No, we moved for summary judgment.
Right. So, if we think that liability against HLF could be resolved on summary judgment, in what sense would you have been prejudiced by the denial of a stay?
If the motion could be decided on the basis of summary judgment, then we wouldn't have been.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
But I just want to remind the court, and this is something that, because of the deference to the government in the procedural aspects of the D.C. case, which I assume would not apply, the same sort of deference wouldn't apply to plaintiffs in a civil case, they refused to consider the affidavits that are in the record in this case. They struck from the record the affidavits that are at issue in this case, in which the principals of the Holy Land Foundation laid out exactly what they did with the money, denied under oath that they had ever had any connection with or had provided any support to Hamas. And so the idea that you could, there could be a summary judgment against Holy Land Foundation under those circumstances, forgive me for, at the risk of overstating it, I think it's inconceivable. The only issue here is whether you can somehow convert this proceeding in Washington into a collateral estoppel issue. And I think for the reasons that we've set forth in the brief, there's every single reason to deny a collateral estoppel motion or attack is there. Every single one of them, with the exception that we were actually, that the Holy Land Foundation was actually represented in the District of Columbia, although I would, in reflection on that, I would say that even that's not entirely true, because if the Court of Appeals is going to decide the case based on secret evidence that we've never seen and that were never presented in court, then I would say even that element of being represented may be missing in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you. May I have a few minutes to rebut?
Of course. I'm just going to find out how many minutes. That was what, seven?
Mr. Boyd was allotted 13 minutes.
Right, no, but I know. Once the red light went on.
3 minutes. We put 3 minutes over.
So 8 minutes. Okay, because I have to add that to the...
So I'll have...
You will have your full rebuttal time, and I'm going to add the 8 minutes to the Boehm's argument. I really will try to be as fair as I know how to be.
Thank you very much.
Yes, of course. Good morning, Mr. Pierce.
Good morning, Your Honor, members of the court. And good morning, Appellee's counsel. I want to start in this difficult case by saying that our clients and my co-counsel certainly extend our sympathies to the plaintiffs in this case.
Could you speak up?
Yes, I'm sorry. I came down with a flu yesterday, and I'm struggling with laryngitis, but I'll do my best.
Somebody can bring you some water if you want.
I drugged myself up, I think, sufficiently. Let me lean forward and use the energy I have, and I do apologize.
Are we going to have...
We don't have many lawyers that admit to being drugged
right,
up.
Are we going to have an ineffective assistance claim because you're on drugs?
You may have such a claim, but I doubt it will be due to the contact that I ingested this morning with breakfast. As counsel for Mohammed Salah and as an officer of this court, I am before you urging a reversal of the judgment that was entered on summary judgment against my client, and indeed asking this court to enter judgment on behalf of my client.
Mr. Pierce, let me start out with...
Please, Judge Rovner.
...this. Because what I want to ask you about is cause in fact. Mr. Salah, your client, and the other defendants argued that the Boehms must be able to establish a direct link between the money or other support they gave to Hamas and David Boehm's murder in particular.
Yes.
But suppose that the Boehms were able to show that all money from donors went into a central pool that Hamas used to fund all of its terrorist activities.
Yes.
Provided there were proof that Hamas killed David Boehm, would that be enough of a causal link, even if you couldn't trace specific dollars from any given donor to any given murder?
My answer to that is that under certain circumstances, of course, the answer would be yes. That is, if there were sufficient proximity in time between money into such a pool and money out of such a pool, I think that the causal nexus could well be found.
In other words, it couldn't be saved somewhere? Are you saying that
it could be.
Proximity and time is the issue?
Proximity and time is an issue, Judge Rovner, not the issue, because what you are positing, of course, is the theory upon which plaintiffs first proceeded in this case. That is, their amended complaint and their initial complaint pled such a pool of funds. I will note that there was no proof of such a pool of funds adduced at the trial court level in front of Magistrate Judge Keyes in these summary judgment proceedings. Absolutely none. But you asked me a hypothetical. I want to answer the hypothetical. I believe that causation, money is fungible. That's why it was invented. And I believe that causation could be found under such circumstances, depending on the other facts in the case. I think it would be difficult under our common law tort concepts to find it if we were talking about many years apart, so that the likelihood that there was any nexus between such money going in and murder coming out, if you will, some years later, becomes extremely attenuated. That is not, however, the case that is before the court. That was not the case that was before Magistrate Judge Keyes, because, again, that was the theory upon which plaintiffs pled this case. That was the theory that plaintiffs represented to this court when we came up upon the motion to dismiss, was the nexus, the causal chain that was going to be shown. And, indeed, that theory has been abandoned because there is no evidence of it. Indeed, there is no evidence that the murderers were Hamas. Indeed, there is no evidence that is admissible that the two defendants identified as the murderers, Al-Sharif and Hanawi, were in fact the murderers. And there is certainly...
Even though they were found to be such?
Well, we don't know what they were found to be, because what we have before us is a document that in the proceedings that my client was involved in, the summary judgment proceedings with regard to Muhammad Salah, was stricken by the court as inadmissible hearsay. It was not a certified copy of a conviction. It was not a transcript. Those proceedings were described as having a confession. We have no confession in this record. What instead we have is unauthenticated notes of an observer, ostensibly from the United States State Department, but we don't even know that, because that's not authenticated either, which are in sketchy summary form of the proceedings of the prosecution against one of these two gentlemen. The other one apparently died in his estate.
Is that undisputed, that the second of these two people blew himself up in a suicide bomb?
I don't know that there is any... It is not asserted as a material fact in our case, and I don't know that we had an opportunity to dispute it. I simply don't know one way or another whether that's true.
I thought that was a given here.
It may be, but, you know, there are many things that are taken too lightly as givens in this case, Judge Evans. And my concern with regard to this case, and I acknowledge I have a difficult argument here, because on the record before you, my client is admitted to have knowingly and actively participated in assisting Hamas's violent activities prior to his incarceration by the Israeli military authorities in January of 1993. That is a fact that we admit, that we must admit when we come before the court. But the question before us is whether there should be liability for a murder that took place some 40 months after he was incarcerated, based on, as this court has ruled, common law principles of tort responsibility. The question in my mind is not whether this man died. I really care not. There is no evidence that my client knew him. There is no evidence that my client had any contact with him. There is no evidence that that man, no admissible evidence, that that man, whether he blew himself up or not, played any role in the tragic and admittedly horrendous murder of plaintiff's child.
I mean, you argue that Mr. Salah couldn't have caused David Boehm's death in any way because he was in jail for the 40 months.
But couldn't.
Isn't it possible that he was taking actions to support Hamas from his jail cell? And in fact, wasn't there some evidence that he actually was doing so?
Well, Your Honor, there is evidence of a most speculative sort that a message which he sought to send out was a coded message to two people that they should not travel to the Middle East. Right? And if we accept that as true, and let me do so for purposes of this argument, still I say to you, the answer to your question, is it possible, is the answer a lawyer always gives to such a question. Anything is possible. The question I respectfully suggest that is before the court is not what is possible, it is what has been proven. And what has been proven here is nothing with regard to the causal nexus that this court has required.
Now, suppose that the Boyms could show that even if Hamas uses some funds for humanitarian purposes, it does so solely to give itself cover for its terrorist activities, and that its ability to carry out terrorism depends on having a variety of humanitarian, let us say, for argument's sake, fronts. Based on that sort of proof, could a fact finder infer that even dollars spent on humanitarian purposes are a cause, in fact, of terrorist activities like the murder of David Boyme?
That is not, by the way, one of the few issues that is not pertinent to my client's claim, but again, I don't wish to avoid the court's question. I will answer the court's question. I think not. And I think not because the concept of proximate causation, which I grant you is not one that has a definition that can be easily flipped open in a law book and applied under all circumstances, as you know better than I in your position, I think would find such funding to be simply too attenuated. At some point, you get back to some equivalent of what we all learned in law school in the Paul's Graph case. There may be, indeed, some very tangential, almost theoretical causation, but proximate causation is what we require in our system of torts, and I don't think that would stand up to common law tort principles, which are the principles of liability that this court has ruled are applicable to the statute under which plaintiffs sue.
And let me ask you one more question, and
please.
It's this. Regarding Hamas's responsibility for the murder, in response to your arguments on that point, the Boyms appear to rely principally on Dr. Paz's affidavit.
Yes.
And you say, among other things, that this is not an issue on which expert testimony is appropriate. And what my question is why not? Given that terrorist organizations are not transparent in their workings, and establishing liability can be difficult.
If we said that, we misspoke, but I think instead we said, Judge Roedner, something slightly different. And let me articulate to you what I think our concerns are with regard to the Paz declaration. Firstly, procedurally, remember that we are before you on summary judgment proceedings. Procedurally, you cannot introduce evidence in summary judgment proceedings in your reply brief. That is where the Paz declaration first appeared.
But there was
cross-briefing,
right,
and therefore it may be in response to our motion for summary judgment.
That argument...
I hear you. But our concern with regard to Mr. Paz's declaration is really this. Mr. Paz's declaration flunks Daubert with flying colors because there is no methodology revealed upon which those conclusions can be rationally measured. Can there be experts on terrorism? Not only can there be, of course there are. I'm sure this court has heard from them. But an expert in terrorism cannot simply be somebody who looks at unauthenticated, and in this case, ruled inadmissible documents and say, well, I'm an expert on terrorism, I can read what those say, by the way, in this case, even though none of the rest of us can, because many of them are in Arabic and not fully translated, and I believe them. We are dealing with an expert who has looked at what are supposedly internet postings. We don't even know if they're internet postings. We do not even know if they are, in fact, internet postings, but one thing every parent knows about the internet is that there is no way of telling who is putting what on the internet absent very well-recognized sites and even in those locations. So here we have this nebulous and evolving ether world of the internet on which people inject things in a foreign language, and without knowing which sites they came from, without knowing who posts them. This expert simply looks at those documents and looks at newspaper articles and says, I reached the conclusion that Hamas was responsible for this killing. And by the way, that is all that Dr. Paz does. He still does not give causation to the plaintiffs. We think that such an expert is merely an avoidance of the federal rules of evidence, does not help the trier of fact, because indeed, if all the expert is doing is saying what is in here is true, those statements should be introduced to the trier of fact, and that is the trier of fact's function, to determine the credibility of statements. And indeed, all Dr. Paz did was parrot hearsay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And that was 5 minutes?
5 minutes.
Okay, so we add 5. And, of course, you'll have your rebuttal, Mr. Pierce.
Thank you.
Sure. All right. Mr. Schiller?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Justices, counsel.
We're just judges.
Judges, I'm sorry.
But thank you.
I represent the American Muslim Society. The facts, obviously, are extensive in the brief. I wanted to talk about two issues. In so doing, obviously, we're not waiving any of the issues we talked about in the other briefs or any of the issues we adopted. One of the issues was causation and cause and fact, which you obviously just extensively talked about with Mr. Pierce. I want to talk about really in three parts. The first part, I want to say that for the purpose of this argument, let's accept every single allegation that the plaintiffs say against not only American Muslim Society, but against every defendant here, was not only good evidence, but was absolutely true. Every single allegation in the summary judgment, every single factual contention and allegation in their summary judgment briefs, responses, cross briefs, and replies, and in their appellate briefs, is absolutely true. What they have still failed to even allege is that anything that any of the defendants did here either played any type of role in the death of David Boehm, or, to go a step further, gave any money that eventually ended up in a pool that played any type of role. To go a step further, there's no allegation, there's no fact, there's no evidence that anything anybody that did, any of the defendants did, before you today, any of the defendant appellants did before you today, did anything that in any way led to the tragic death of Mr. Boehm.
Could I ask you something? Because
sure.
I mean, this is a fairly common theme. Going back to this court's earlier decision, the briefs throughout, particularly the Boehm's briefs, but the other briefs, identify 3 points that need to be shown for aiding and abetting liability. One, that the defendant, we'll assume your client, AMS, knew that the person to whom contributions were being made engaged in illegal terrorist activities. 2, that they intended to further those activities. And 3, they committed an act that furthered the terrorists' activities. So if you make all those generous assumptions you were about to make, then why shouldn't we find that it's incontrovertible for summary judgment purposes that AMS knew that they were, that when they gave money to HLF, it was really just a front for passing it on through to Hamas, which is a known terrorist organization. They intended to further Hamas's activities. They create all these programs. They bring the speakers over, and they do all these things. And by sending the money, they have, in fact, contributed material support to that. Why doesn't that all add up?
And in the process of answering that,
I mean, in other words, I mean, there's a level of generality issue here. I mean, the defense has wanted the focus more to be on David Boehm's death, and we covered this a little bit earlier with Mr. Boyd, whereas our earlier opinion doesn't seem to be quite so confined.
Well, I'm not going to tell this court what it wrote. but it seems...
Or at least there's a debate about it. Will,
right.
You can tell us.
So I can tell you what my interpretation was. It seems, and especially if you look to the cases that this court cited, that when you're talking about knowledge, intent, and support, you're talking about specific knowledge, specific intent, and specific support. In the very least, you got to have some type, and that's how you, and that's really how you create cause and fact. When you talk about the Haberstam case, the lady knew that he was what he did, but also knew what he was going out to do on a given on that particular night.
But why should it matter if it's Hamas? And we'll just have to assume for the moment, I don't want to get into a big debate about this, let's assume that we know that Hamas is a terrorist organization and that one of the things terrorist organizations do is they go out and randomly kill people in order to terrorize. Why does it matter if they kill one person versus another person? It happened to be David Boehm, unfortunately, but it could have been, I mean, it has been, you know, many other people. There are concepts of transferred intent. There are concepts of specific intent to kill that may not depend on the identity of the person who died.
I think there's three answers to that.
Right.
One, as Mr. Pierce said, I think it might not matter if there is an actual causal connection of any type. If there is actually proof that there was support and that somehow or another there was a pool or something else that they should have known about. But even that is a type of specific intent. We know that there's this pool. We know that this money is going to go to help violence, and then there's a causal connection. In fact, some of the money in one way or another either helped or aided other things to help. There's some, even if it's attenuated, even if it helped this person who helped this person who helped this person who helped who did the thing. But there's some chain. There's some connection. The second part of the answer, which I want to move quickly into my second part of the causation, is specifically in the case of the American Muslim Society. I said, I was trying to defend all defense at first. Let me talk about the American Muslim Society. The totality of their allegations is that the American Muslim Society did three things. They had conferences in which there was pro Hamas speakers. They paid for pro Hamas speakers to come to those conferences, and they put out various pieces of propaganda that at times they say support Hamas. All of those, again, let's accept all of those allegations are true. In the first instance, we're talking about, in the situation you described, an unlimited possible potential number of defendants. Any defendant who actually does support Hamas is then liable. I'm sorry, we're talking about a potential unlimited number of plaintiffs. Any defendant who does support Hamas is then liable for every single thing Hamas does under the scenario you posit. The question is, on the other end, where is the line drawn on the other end? According to them, any defendant who does even the smallest bit of support is also liable for every possible plaintiff. Somebody who holds a conference and has a pro Hamas speaker is liable. Well, you know, and as may I have two more minutes?
Yes, of course.
You know, and as I gave various examples in the reply brief, that you can extend that forever. You know, the butcher on Devon Street who gives Meir Kahan a slice of roast beef because he supports his organization, is he now responsible for any American killed in Israel? You have to not only do you draw the line in terms of who the possible plaintiffs are that were actually injured by the conduct of the defendants, but you have to draw the line somewhere who the possible defendants are based on their conduct. The third part of this argument is, I believe the record is undisputed that AMS didn't even provide a slice of corned beef. AMS did not do the three things that they didn't even do the three minor things that they were alleged to do. You know, Mr. Boyd talked a little bit about some of the distortions and lies in the record, or claimed to be in the record. And I'm not going to get into the translations, but there's four or five things. And the Boehms claim that AMS distorted the record. I just want to point out a few distortions from the record. The Boehms said in their brief, quote, contrary to AMS's assertions, Jaber admits that he formed AMS with the intention of giving corporate formality to his active role in IAP National. And then they cite the record. The record actually says, quote, question, okay, but in forming AMS, was it always expected that you would be in some fashion working with or affiliated with IAP National? Yeah, we would work with IP National or any other organization for that matter, not just IP National. They then go about asking that same essential question five different ways throughout the record and start getting answers like, no, no, we did not do that. The Boyms say...
Are you saying they got a yes first and then...
They never got it. They claim that IP was formed as part... AMS was formed as IP, as part of AP. They never got a yes. They got, we would work with IP National. We would also work with any other organization. When they tried to say, were you formed as part of IP? The answer was no. No, we were not. The Boyms say that Jabber admitted IP National paid the expenses for Amos Lears to travel to his national conferences. That's at their brief.
But, I mean, given the overlap in leadership and the shifting of assets, couldn't a fact finder reasonably infer that this was really one organization moving from corporation to corporation?
Sure, if a fact finder had an opportunity to hear it, maybe. If a fact finder had an opportunity to view Rafiq Jabber's testimony, if a fact finder had an opportunity to hear some actual direct and some redirect and some recross and some rehabilitation, maybe that's what we need to have happen. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. That was what, two?
That was
3 minutes. 3. Okay. I feel like a scorekeeper up here. Okay, Mr. Beal, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I would like to start by emphasizing that I represent the Chronic Literacy Institute. QLI has always had a legitimate purpose. We submitted as Exhibit 25 to our summary judgment motion 7 of the books that QLI published. Its purpose has been to prepare and publish commentaries on sacred Islamic texts.
Mr. Beal, I have to ask you why you did not participate to any degree in the trial that was, everyone else is here up on summary judgment, but that was not the case with QLI. I mean, I know it's hard to be a solo practitioner and not have much time, but to sit there and do nothing isn't a very attractive posture.
Well, if I had participated and represented QLI totally incompetently, I would be up here in a more difficult position. I'd be up here with the same judgment against me, not having provided adequate representation.
I don't understand, though, how you can have been participating in the case all that time without having, you know, at least some cross-examination coming into your mind or something. It seemed to me a very risky strategy on your part.
It was a risky strategy, Judge, but we knew that there was a December 1st trial date had been set. We didn't know when the summary judgment motions were going to be ruled on.
You never know.
That's true, Judge, but we're in a situation...
I mean, you know, lawyers prepare for trial. What I'm wondering, Mr. Beal, is suppose that we order a new trial. Would QLS simply sit on its hands again?
No, Judge. We would fully participate in a new trial. We would have more than 3 weeks to prepare. I would not expect an extended time frame, but we were... two things. First of all, we had funding, and I discussed this in my motion for continuance. We had modest funding for the initial interlocutory appeal and the summary judgment and the discovery that went with it. QLI ran out of money upon the filing of the summary judgment. So as we're headed toward trial, we have no money for expenses, for experts, and then the summary judgment comes down, and boom, we have to go to trial. The three other parties are out of the case, who I had, quite frankly, expected to rely on. In that time period, I wasn't getting paid. I didn't have money for litigation expenses. I didn't know what the trial was going to look like. And suddenly I'm faced with having to be the only person on trial 3 weeks later. I mean, I know how to try a case. I've tried many cases in the district court. I couldn't possibly get ready in 3 weeks. It couldn't be done to try the case all by myself. And so I move for a continuance. I recommend that the court look at the motion, which was filed on November 15th, because it sets out in considerable detail why we needed at least a couple more months. The judge denied it, simply saying, I read your motion. I find the postponement based on the reasons set forth in your motion is not warranted. I'm going to deny the request without giving any reasons. I would submit that is, in fact, an abuse of discretion because he didn't exercise discretion. We don't know why he turned it down. There were a variety of compelling reasons that continuances are granted all the time in the district court on, and he simply brushed them aside because he was fixated on this trial date. I have an obligation to properly represent my client. I could not do that in the three-week period between the time summary judgment was rendered and the trial was supposed to commence. There was no, and I would submit to the court, there's no legitimate reason why the court could not have given at least a couple more months so that I could prepare to try the case all by myself. I mean, you can say I should have done it before, but the reality was there's such a disparity of litigation resources in this case that I didn't do it, and I was not in a position to do it. I had other cases I was preparing for. At that time, I mentioned this in the motion, we were actively working on the expert discovery in the death penalty case I tried in the district court in April.
I know, but here's the problem. The trial date had been set months before, and all defendants were obliged to prepare for trial despite the possibility of summary judgment. I mean, that's the way our system works. We're talking about an abuse of discretion here. And I mean, what kind of precedent would we be setting if we said, you know, you can just for other cases? I mean, it's really a problem.
Yes, Joe. Well, I would submit that this case is not like other cases. This is there was a $156 million judgment in this case. This was a case where I expected, maybe I was not reading the tea leaves right in the summary judgment, but I didn't expect to be trying this case all alone. If we had had four parties at trial, I could have handled one fourth of the weight of the trial. But to handle the whole trial was something that I was simply not prepared to do in this 3 week period. And all we were asking for was a couple of months, which is not. An open-ended request, and the judge gave. I really would commend the motion to the court, and then look at the judge's response, which was a no. I mean, the judge gave no reasons as to why he denied the continuance, even though I provided him with four or five what I would submit are compelling reasons. And so I submit that the abuse of discretion is the failure to exercise discretion by not giving any reason why he didn't give the continuance.
Did you have anything, since your time is running low, on the merits of this appeal you wanted to?
Well, the one issue that I just wanted to mention briefly is the issue of Judge Key's ruling that the plaintiffs didn't have to prove the element of that Hamas was responsible for David Boehm's death. I think it's important to understand that he did that in the context of the summary judgment proceedings. In his November 24th memorandum on ruling on motions in limine, which is a week before the trial started, he said on page 8, given that the court has already determined that Hamas was responsible for David Boehm's death, applying that to QLI,
could he not have granted partial summary judgment in the QLI part of the case to that effect?
He would have, but only under Seventh Circuit rules, if he had given me notice that he was going to do so, and I would have had a chance to oppose it, and I would have opposed it, because we participated in summary judgment. And he gave no hint that he was going to do this, so I didn't say anything in the summary judgment proceeding. And from Mr. Peer's argument, it's obvious there is a strong case to be made that's incorrect. So if he had given me notice and I'd had a chance to participate in summary judgment proceeding and then he'd made the ruling, then it would have been it could have been acceptable anyway. But he did not give me that opportunity. That violates the law of the Seventh Circuit, and therefore that was improper, and deprived us of I mean, it was improper to apply that to the trial after having made it improperly against us in the summary judgment proceeding. So if the court has no other questions, I would ask the court to reverse the judgment below and to remand the case for a new trial in which we would, in fact, participate, or to grant judgment in favor of QOI.
Thank you, Mr. Beal. 2 minutes. All right. So, 13, 16, 18. All right. Mr. Lewin?
You don't have to feel compelled to use every minute.
We're going to add 18 minutes to your time, and you use it as you see fit.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court. In 1992, Congress passed a law which, according to this court's opinion in 2002, was designed, and I quote, to extend civil liability for acts of international terrorism to the full reaches of traditional tort law, and, again I quote, to allow a plaintiff to recover from anyone along the causal chain of terrorism. This case, which is the first to arrive in a court of appeals after a full contested adversary proceeding resulting in a money judgment for a party that is an intended beneficiary of this law, has a number of unusually strong elements of proof that favor the plaintiffs that are seldom going to be repeated in future litigation. And it is really a landmark and a guidepost for the enforcement of this law.
But Mr. Lewin, let me just start with that chain of causation. If I understood your brief correctly, you don't think there's a beginning point there with cause and fact. You think that this is... And I don't see how you can get into a proximate cause discussion without... You know, it's somewhere, you know, the beginning of the world, maybe, you know, or the birth of the defendant or something. There has to be some point that is a cause in fact of what follows.
The point, Judge Wood, is that this court has said not that there's a causation requirement, but the question is, in terms of aiding and abetting and conspiracy law, what are the foreseeable consequences of what you do?
Well, but no, but here's where I want to at least get some greater clarity than the magistrate judge's opinion gave me. You mentioned two key theories here, aiding and abetting and conspiracy. Each of these theories has criteria that need to be proved. Our prior opinion discussed aiding and abetting, and kind of in passing mentioned conspiracy. Then, as I understand, the complaint was amended. But they have different criteria, and the magistrate judge does not clearly distinguish between these theories and which defendants might be liable under which theories. And I think some of them are stronger than others vis-a-vis the role that various defendants played. For example, aiding and abetting, if you don't enter the picture until 2 years later, doesn't sound very plausible, whereas perhaps a conspiracy theory, if you join a conspiracy and you understand the scope of the agreement and you understand, you know, you kind of sign up, then in under conspiracy law, perhaps things that have already happened can be attributed to you. That's just an example, but I don't find it would help me a lot if you could clarify which theory you think applies to which defendants.
Our view, Judge Wood, is that both aiding and abetting and conspiracy apply to all the defendants.
Well, I don't quite see that, but if you could just maybe, and I don't mean to preempt what my colleagues might want to ask you, but I would be helped a lot if you could explain why.
If there is, Hamas was formed as an organization in 1987. That's beyond dispute. It began shortly thereafter, and I would commend to the court really the reading of the Judge Duffy's opinion in the Marzouk case, which outlines from between 1990 and 1994 a series of 10 different terrorist acts which were committed, publicized, taken credit for by Hamas, which were exactly of the nature of the killing of David Boyne, which was random shootings, stabbings, explosions on buses, all within that period between 1990.
Let me just to play the devil's advocate. I mean, the IRA was doing things like that too during this period of time. I mean, there are some terrible organizations around
there
the world, and yet we don't just sort of sweepingly hold people who gave money to them, either to organizations that they may have controlled or something, without, you know, connecting the dots, basically.
The dots are connected, Judge Wood, by the fact that one knows that that organization engages continually in this kind of activity, and one says, with the intention, as this court has said, of furthering that kind of activity, here I am contributing material support, money, to carry that out. It may very well be that in this whole chain of events, and I think I said to the court when I last appeared back in 2001, this is Murder Incorporated. If what you do is you say, look, I'm going to be a charter member, I will pay whatever amount of money it is to become a supporter of this organization that engages in random murders, then until such time, and this is conspiracy theory, until
right.
such
it's
time
conspiracy.
As you withdraw with the standards that are provided in the criminal law for withdrawal from conspiracies, you are a conspirator. There are continuous, in the certainly in the drug area, with which this court sometimes encounters cases, there are drug conspiracies that engage, that are participated in over long periods of time for the sale of drugs.
But, you know, remember when you were here before, one of our concerns was how far back you push this. You know, suppose there's some family who are Muslims and they write a check as part of their almsgiving to Holy Land Foundation, and Holy Land Foundation then gives that gives a comparable amount of money to an orphanage in the West Bank, and then it turns out that Hamas runs that orphanage, and because they don't have to pay that money for the orphanage, they have that much more money for their terrorist activities, therefore, of course, dollars fungible, they're supported. Why not sue the family?
Your Honor, there are other hard cases. They have not been brought. We have not sued a family that contributed in 1987 to Hamas when it was formed.
But
the
AMS,
Holy Land family.
AMS claims, though, that it at most was passing checks along to Holy Land Foundation, and it claims that there is not admissible evidence to show that they knew that Holy Land Foundation was a front for Hamas.
Well, we submit there is substantial evidence to the contrary. There is, in 1989, beginning with 1989, the appearance of a veiled Hamas official at IAP.
That was an IAP meeting. I mean, right, we need
right.
to link up
in
IAP
1993, there are intercepted conversations which demonstrate, again, the support that this organization, that IAP, AMS, which we think, again, there was, but in the testimony of Mr. Jabber, you know, it's been said that he had never acknowledged that AMS was formed to continue IAP. There's a, in his second deposition, an answer to the question of the questioner said, if I understood your testimony before lunch, part of the reason you formed AMS was to give a more concrete and permanent, if you will, organization to the activities that you were doing associated with IAP National, correct? And he says, yes, yes. Then he goes on and says you can raise funds for organizations, but he says, so we needed to make it real, official, in the legal way. There's no doubt about the fact, the whole sequence of officials.
So you're saying it's just really one corporation, and
we're saying in substance, and that's what Judge Keyes found. Again, I think, in terms of comparing this with possible future cases that might be brought under this statute, you have here a judge, a magistrate.